sent a second set of inspectors to duplicate the effort of the first set. Since taxation was based not on population but on land and its usage, the inspectors made a valiant effort to count every ox, cow, and pig, but didn't gather much data about the people who shoveled their droppings. Even if population data had been relevant, in medieval times, a statistical survey regarding the most vital statistics about humans, their lifespans, and diseases, would have been considered inconsistent with the traditional Christian concept of death. According to that doctrine, it was wrong to make death the object of speculation, and almost sacrilegious to look for laws governing it. For whether a person died from a lung infection, a stomach ache, or a rock whose impact exceeded the compressive strength of his skull, the true cause of his or her death was considered to be simply God's will. Over the centuries, that fatalistic attitude gradually gave way, yielding to an opposing view, according to which, by studying the regularities of nature and society, we are not challenging God's authority, but rather learning about his ways. A big step in that transformation of views came in the 16th century, when the Lord Mayor of London ordered the compilation of weekly bills of mortality to account for the christenings and burials recorded by parish clerks. For decades, the bills were compiled sporadically, but in 1603, one of the worst years of the plague, the city instituted a weekly tally. Theorists on the continent turned up their noses at the data-laden mortality bills as peculiarly English and of little use. But, to one peculiar Englishman, a shopkeeper named John Grant, the tallies told a gripping tale. Grant and his friend William Petty have been called the founders of statistics, a field sometimes considered lowbrow by those in pure mathematics owing to its focus on mundane practical issues. And in that sense, Grant in particular makes a fitting founder. For unlike some of the amateurs who developed probability, Cardano, the doctor, Fermat, the jurist, or Bayes, the clergyman, Grant was a seller of common notions, buttons, thread, needles, and other small items used in a household. But Grant wasn't just a button salesman. He was a wealthy button salesman, and his wealth afforded him the leisure to pursue interests having nothing to do with implements for holding garments together. It also enabled him to befriend some of the greatest intellectuals of his day, including Petty. One inference Grant gleaned from the mortality bills concerned the number of people who starved to death. In 1665, that number was reported to be 45, only about double the number who had died from execution. In contrast, 4,808 were reported to have died from consumption, 1,929 from spotted fever and purples, 2,614 from teeth and worms, and 68,596 from the plague. Why, when London was teeming with beggars, did so few starve? Grant concluded that the populace must be feeding the hungry, and so he proposed instead that the state provide the food, thereby costing society nothing, while ridding the 17th century London streets of their equivalent of panhandlers and squeegee men. Grant also weighed in on the two leading theories of how the plague is spread. One theory held that the illness was transmitted by foul air. The other, that it was transmitted from person to person. Grant looked at the week-to-week records of deaths and concluded that the fluctuations in the data were too great to be random, as he expected they would be if the person-to-person theory were correct. On the other hand, since weather varies erratically week by week, he considered the fluctuating data to be consistent with the foul air theory. As it turned out, London was not ready for soup kitchens, and Londoners would have fared better if they had avoided ugly rats rather than foul air. But Grant's great discoveries lay not in his conclusions. They lay instead in his realization that statistics can provide insights into the system from which the statistics are derived. Petty's work is sometimes considered a harbinger of classical economics. Believing that the strength of the state depends on and is reflected by the number and character of its subjects, Petty employed statistical reasoning to analyze national issues. Typically, his analyses were made from the point of view of the sovereign and treated members of society as objects to be manipulated at will. Regarding the plague, he pointed out that money should be spent on prevention because, in saving lives, the realm would preserve part of the considerable investment society made in raising men and women to maturity, and therefore would reap a higher return than it would on the most lucrative of alternative investments. Regarding the Irish, Petty was not as charitable. He concluded, for example, that the economic value of an English life was greater than that of an Irish one, so the wealth of the kingdom would be increased if all Irishmen, except a few cowherds, were forcibly relocated to England. As it happened, Petty owned his own wealth to those same Irish. As a doctor with the invading British army in the 1650s, he had been given the task of assessing the spoils and assessed that he could get away with grabbing a good share for himself, which he did. If, as Petty believed, the size and growth of a population reflect the quality of its government, then the lack of a good method for measuring the size of a population made the assessment of its government difficult. Grant's most famous calculations address that issue, in particular the population of London. From the bills of mortality, Grant knew the number of births. Since he had a rough idea of the fertility rate, he could infer how many women were of childbearing age. That datum allowed him to guess the total number of families and, using his own observations of the mean size of a London family, thereby estimate the city's population. He came up with 384,000. Previously, it was believed to be 2 million. Grant also raised eyebrows by showing that much of the growth of the city was due to immigration from outlying areas, not to the slower method of procreation, and that despite the horrors of the plague, the decrease in population due to even the worst epidemic was always made up within 2 years. In addition, Grant is generally credited with publishing the first life table, a systematic arrangement of life expectancy data that today is widely employed by organizations, from life insurance companies to the World Health Organization, that are interested in knowing how long people live. A life table displays how many people, in a group of 100, can be expected to survive to any given age. In 1662, Grant published his analyses in Natural and Political Observations Upon the Bills of Mortality. The book met with acclaim. A year later, Grant was elected to the Royal Society. Then, in 1666, the Great Fire of London, which burned down a large part of the city, destroyed his business. To add insult to injury, he was accused of helping to cause the destruction by giving instructions to halt the water supply just before the fire started. In truth, he had no affiliation with the water company until after the fire. Still, after that episode, Grant's name disappeared from the books of the Royal Society. Grant died of jaundice a few years later. Largely because of Grant's work, in 1667 the French fell in line with the British and revised their legal code to enable surveys like the Bills of Mortality. Other European countries followed suit. By the 19th century, statisticians all over Europe were up to their elbows in government records such as census data, an avalanche of numbers. Grant's legacy was to demonstrate that inferences about a population as a whole could be made by carefully examining a limited sample of data. But though Grant and others made valiant efforts to learn from the data through the application of simple logic, most of the data's secrets awaited the development of the tools created by Gauss, Laplace, and others in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The term statistics entered the English language from the German word Statistik through a 1770 translation of the book Bielefeld's Elementary Universal Education. which stated that the science that is called statistics teaches us what is the political arrangement of all the modern states of the known world. By 1828, the subject had evolved such that Noah Webster's American Dictionary defined statistics as a collection of facts respecting the state of society, the condition of the people in a nation or country, their health, longevity, domestic economy, arts, property, and political strength, the state of their country, etc. The field had embraced the methods of Laplace, who had sought to extend his mathematical analysis from planets and stars to issues of everyday life. The normal distribution describes the manner in which many phenomena vary around a central value that represents their most probable outcome. In his Essai Philosophique sur la Probabilité, Laplace argued that this new mathematics could be employed to assess legal testimony, predict marriage rates, calculate insurance premiums. But by the final edition of that work, Laplace was in his 60s, and so it fell to a younger man to develop his ideas. That man was Adolphe Quetelet, born in Ghent, Flanders, on February 22, 1796. Quetelet did not enter his studies spurred by a keen interest in the workings of society. His dissertation, which in 1819 earned him the first doctorate in science awarded by the new university in Ghent, was on the theory of conic sections, a topic in geometry. His interest then turned to astronomy, and around 1820 he became active in a movement to found a new observatory in Brussels, where he had taken a position. An ambitious man, Quetelet apparently saw the observatory as a step toward establishing a scientific empire. It was an audacious move, not least because he knew relatively little about astronomy and virtually nothing about running an observatory. But he must have been persuasive because not only did his observatory receive funding, but he personally received a grant to travel to Paris for several months to remedy the deficiencies in his knowledge. It proved a sound investment, for Quetelet's Royal Observatory of Belgium is still in existence today. In Paris, Quetelet was affected in his own way by the disorder of life, and it pulled him in a completely different direction. His romance with statistics began when he made the acquaintance of several great French mathematicians, including Laplace and Joseph Fourier, and studied statistics and probability with Fourier. In the end, though he learned how to run an observatory, he fell in love with a different pursuit, the idea of applying the mathematical tools of astronomy to social data. When Quetelet returned to Brussels, he began to collect and analyze demographic data, soon focusing on records of criminal activity that the French government began to publish in 1827. In Sur l'homme et le développement de ses facultés, a two-volume work he published in 1835, Quetelet printed a table of annual murders reported in France from 1826 to 1831. The number of murders, he noted, was relatively constant, as was the proportion of murders committed each year, with guns, swords, knives, canes, stones, instruments for cutting and stabbing, kicks and punches, strangulation, drowning, and fire. Quetelet also analyzed mortality according to age, geography, season, and profession, as well as in hospitals and prisons. He studied statistics on drunkenness, insanity, and crime, and he discovered statistical regularities describing suicide by hanging in Paris and the number of marriages between 60-something women and 20-something men in Belgium. Statistics had conducted such studies before, but Quetelet did something more with the data. He went beyond examining the average to scrutinizing the manner in which the data strayed from its average. Wherever he looked, Quetelet found the normal distribution, in the propensities to crime, marriage, and suicide, and in the height of American Indians and the chest measurements of Scottish soldiers. He came upon a sample of 5,738 chest measurements in an old issue of the Edinburgh Medical and Surgical Journal. In the height of 100,000 young Frenchmen called up for the draft, He also found meaning in a deviation from the normal distribution. In that data, when the number of conscripts was plotted against their height, the bell-shaped curve was distorted. Too few prospects were just above 5'2", and a compensating surplus was just below that height. Ketola argued that the difference, about 2,200 extra short men, was due to fraud, or, you might say, friendly fudging, as those below 5'2" were excused from service. Decades later, the great French mathematician Jules-Henri Poincaré employed Ketola's method to nab a baker who was shortchanging his customers. At first, Poincaré, who made a habit of picking up a loaf of bread each day, noticed after weighing his loaves that the average was about 950 grams, instead of the 1,000 grams advertised. He complained to the authorities and afterward received bigger loaves. Still, he had a hunch that something about his bread wasn't kosher. And so, with the patience only a famous, or at least tenured, scholar can afford, he carefully weighed his bread every day for the next year. Though his bread now averaged closer to 1,000 grams, if the baker had been honestly handing him random loaves, the number of loaves heavier and lighter than the mean should have, as I mentioned in Chapter 7, diminished following the bell-shaped pattern of the error law. Instead, Poincaré found that there were too few light loaves and a surplus of heavy ones. He concluded that the baker had not ceased baking underweight loaves, but instead was seeking to placate him by always giving him the largest loaf he had on hand. The police again visited the cheating baker, who was reportedly appropriately astonished, and presumably agreed to change his ways. Ketola had stumbled on a useful discovery. The patterns of randomness are so reliable that in certain social data, their violation can be taken as evidence of wrongdoing. Today, such analyses are applied to reams of data too large to have been analyzed in Ketola's time. In recent years, in fact, such statistical sleuthing has become popular, creating a new field called forensic economics, perhaps the most famous example of which is the statistical study suggesting that companies were backdating their stock option grants. The idea is simple. Companies grant stock options, the right to buy shares later at the price of the stock on the date of the grant, as an incentive for executives to improve their firm's share prices. If the grants are backdated to times when the shares were especially low, the executive's profits will be correspondingly high. A clever idea, but when done in secret, it violates securities laws. It also leaves a statistical fingerprint, which has led to the investigation of such practices at about a dozen major companies. In a less publicized example, Justin Wolfers, an economist at the Wharton School, found evidence of fraud in the results of about 70,000 college basketball games. Wolfers discovered the anomaly by comparing Las Vegas bookmakers' point spreads to the game's actual outcomes. When one team is favored, the bookmakers offer point spreads in order to attract a roughly even number of bets on both competitors. For instance, suppose the basketball team at Caltech is considered better than the team at UCLA. For college basketball fans, yes, this was actually true in the 1950s. Rather than assigning lopsided odds, bookies could instead offer an even bet on the game, but pay out on a Caltech bet only if their team beat UCLA by, say, 13 or more points. Though such point spreads are set by the bookies, they are really fixed by the mass of bettors because the bookies adjust them to balance the demand. Bookies make their money on fees and seek to have an equal amount of money bet on each side so that they can't lose, whatever the outcome. To measure how well bettors assess two teams, economists use a number called the forecast error, which is the difference between the favored team's margin of victory and the point spread determined by the marketplace. It may come as no surprise that forecast error, being a type of error, is distributed according to the normal distribution. Wolfers found that its mean is zero, meaning that the point spreads don't tend to either over-